You are on ABC Overnights. I'm Sally Knight, and it is time for our Saturday morning talking point. We're talking about technology, the internet, and online security. A lot of people now shop online. You might purchase all sorts of stuff online through retailers like eBay, where you put in your details, credit card details, address, name, phone number. A lot of our data and our information is now shared online. So we're speaking this morning to internet security commentator and expert, Still Garion. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Sally. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us at this
my pleasure.
Lovely early hour on a Saturday morning.
My pleasure.
Now, this has been quite a juicy topic lately, internet security breaches. I feel like there's been all sorts of breaches, eBay accounts, stealing credit card information from Target's online customers, more recently the Apple, you know, sort of devices being held to ransom. What's going on?
what's going on is that humans are using the internet, and some of us humans are not honest people. I think that's the short answer. The people who are the real experts on internet security, and thank you for calling me an expert, but no, I'm going to have people like complaining about that.
People will be calling you a hacker, you know that. No.
Yes. And also the guys and girls who really are working on the front line will go, look, he might know a bit, but he just talks about it on the radio and stuff. Don't pay too much attention to him. But look, for a few years now, all of the folks who really do know are saying, this is pretty much what was going to happen. As the internet, when it was first designed as a thing and started being built 40 years ago now, people forget that it was an academic and military research network at the very beginning. And because it came from that kind of academic environment where people were openly sharing information for the advancement of science and human knowledge and so on, they didn't think too much about making it secure for commercial transactions. And by the time that we got to, well, let's say the mid-1990s, 1994, 95, were the real breakthroughs when ordinary people started using the internet. Now, ordinary people were on the internet before, but they had to be either working in a company that did stuff for the United States government or something like that, or a big technology corporation, or they had to be a university student.
Yep.
But in 1994 and 95, the gates were opened, essentially, that anyone could start using the internet, and commercial internet service providers came on the scene. And that was the beginning. Now, you know, we're, good heavens, nearly 20 years after that. So there's those two phases of the internet, two 20-year periods. We're coming to the end of the kind of second one. And now, in a country like Australia, the internet is normal for everyone to use. I mean, you know, you enter a competition, they will say the terms and conditions are on our website. So that's the big picture history. What's happened, though, is that all of that internet infrastructure, security wasn't designed in from the beginning, so it's been built in as we've then gone along, and also because we've built a computer network globally that is currently dealing with something like what's more than 2 billion devices, that's billion with a B. It's one of the greatest engineering achievements that humans have ever done, and yet it's invisible. And like all such things that's built in a very great hurry, it's a bit rough at the edges, to be perfectly honest. and so, you know, the hackers have an easier job at it than you might think.
So there's the hardware, right? There's the device. And then there's the companies that build those devices. Then there's the software that you put on these devices. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to someone who's trying to breach, you know, those devices and that software, can you explain how exactly a hacker might be able to access our personal information on computers or on our phones, you know?
Okay, look, there's lots of ways that it can be done, but the common element in all of it is either that the software that's running on the devices has a bug in it, a programming error, and the people who wrote the software thought that they'd covered all the possibilities for someone getting in, so that only the legitimate user could get in. And, unfortunately that's not the case, and someone's discovered that hole. I mean, it's a bit like you go around the back of a warehouse and you notice that all of the doors and windows of the warehouse have TV cameras covering them and solid locks, except for the toilet window. And someone realizes, aha, if I wait till late at night and climb in the toilet window, I can do that. The kind of internet equivalent or device equivalent is, aha, they think that I won't be able to get into their supposedly secure website without a legitimate username and password, but if I access it using this particular obscure and difficult request, that'll actually break through that. Or they think they've stored the passwords in a secure way, but maybe not so much. And the other possibility is, there's several there, but I guess it's people make mistakes. People are always the weakest link. So they get someone's legitimate username and password by nefarious means. And the most common one at the moment here is what's called a phishing attack with a PH. PH.
Mm. When I've... I get a lot of spam, and I've no idea how these people have really got my email address to start with, but there's a little option in these email providers that says, you know, you can tick this as a phishing scam. So is that kind of what you're discussing here?
Yeah. Essentially that, you know, you'll get an email in which says, Sally, problem with your PayPal account, better click here to resolve that problem. Mm-hmm. You click on that link and you go to a site which looks absolutely like the PayPal website because they've copied it, but it's not. And if you're worried that your account's been frozen, you want to get your money, so you panic, you type in your username and password, except you've just typed it into the fraudster's website. That's a phishing attack.
So that's you're actually willingly giving your information to someone who's phishing for it, right?
Yeah. Look, and that happens old school. You could do it on the phone. I could phone up and say, you know, because we used to have only just the four big banks in Australia, we've only still got a limited number of banks. If I start phoning telephone numbers at random, and you say, how will I know my phone number? We just choose a random number. You don't know who's at the other end. Or you steal someone's mail from their mailbox, so you've got their bank statements or whatever it might be, and you know their name and address and their account number. Just phone them up and start talking to them as if you're from the bank. And then say, oh, by the way, just to verify who you are, can I have your date of birth, thank you? And you think it's from the bank, and you give it to the person. So that's an old school thing. That's not even computer hacking, but it's like, no, your bank won't phone you and ask for your date of birth, or they shouldn't. So those are the phishing type attacks. They're also called social engineering. They're trying to con you into giving over personal information.
I love those sorts of emails. They say, help, I've been kidnapped in a country. Can you please transfer this amount of money to me immediately? And I'm, I didn't even know my friend was in Italy at the moment or whatever. So,
although they get better at that now, they actually first, if they've managed to break into someone's Facebook account, say, they can just watch that for a while. And they don't even have to break into it if the person's left their Facebook account being quite public. They can just read and say, oh, they're on holiday in France. So I'll just phone their friends and tell them, as you say, that story, I've lost my purse and, you know, the embassy is sorting it out, but I just need $1,000 to get through things for the next few days and get the hotel bill paid, and then I'll be okay. So, there's a mix of technical attacks and there's a mix of social attacks.
So the social attacks, phishing, and then there's also the gaps in the software, which people who know what they're doing can suss out and try and find and then
Well, that's right. Mm. And you can join the two together. So in the case just recently, eBay was in the news the other day because they exposed to the world a list of all of their users, which included their usernames, their email addresses, their names, their dates of birth, their addresses. It's actually one of the most serious data breaches in history.
That's that names, addresses, dates of birth.
Oh, yes.
That's pretty serious.
Yes, eBay has managed to, through very good media management, concentrate on the passwords. And I'm sure this was a deliberate PR strategy. They've made sure all the media is about, you need to change your password, you need to change your password.
Mm.
Now, the passwords were probably kept in a secure way. You know, as soon as someone says, I can email you your password, you know that they're not keeping the password securely, because even they should not know what the password is. There's some mathematical tricks you can use to store what's called a hash of the password, and then when someone wants to log in, they try and log in using that password, the same mathematical trick happens, and then you compare, well, did we get the same answer? Okay, they must have put in the right password, even though we don't know what the password was. But in eBay's case, that database of nearly 150 million people around the world has all of those other personal details too. Now, that's actually the big scare story. In pure numbers terms, it's in the top five data breaches of all time. But that other information, sure, you know, yeah, change your password. You can't change your date of birth. You can't easily change your home address.
People have that, you know, that information now that you just can't go and, yeah, change your birthday. No.
Well,
you might be able to move house, but you
can't. even then, you know, you phone up your telephone company. I mean, if you want to make changes to your phone account, what do you do? They want your phone number, your name, your address, your date of birth. You know, that's bingo. You've got their mobile phone account. And you say, oh, good, now that I'm on the phone, I better tell you that my home address has changed. So you change your home address. So the bad guys then change the home address to their delivery address.
Mm.
And then they say, oh, good, now, can you courier me out the new smartphone I wanted to order? Just put that on my account.
Oh, it's clever. Very clever.
How it's done.
So, look, we are speaking with Stilgarian this morning on ABC Overnights. He is a technology commentator and an expert on internet security. And we will be taking calls. If you've got any questions, any comments, if, you know, anything that we've mentioned so far, raising flags, red flags, you want to discuss it, you can call 1-300-800-222. Maybe you've been hacked yourself. I know I've had my Facebook account hacked, my Twitter account hacked. You know, I've been completely locked out of my email. And, yeah, it's just, how do these people get in, you know? So we'll be talking about that, and I'd love to hear about your experiences. 1-300-800-222. We've had a text in, Stilgarian, from Graham in Lamia in New South Wales. He wants to know how safe PayPal is, because PayPal is used a lot for online monetary transactions, for example, with eBay. So after this eBay breach, was PayPal in any way implicated?
Well, I can reassure Graham there that the official answer from eBay is that although eBay owns PayPal and is closely integrated with it, their systems are completely separate. And so this wasn't affected in any way. Now, we'll have to believe them because they're required by American law to actually give details of when a data breach happens. And just as a side note, we don't have such laws in Australia, so if it happens here, they can just pretend it didn't happen. But for American companies or companies operating in America, they have to tell us what's going on. So in this case, they spent some time after they discovered the problem. It was a couple of weeks before they went public with it, which they've been roasted for. You know, why did you take so long? I still haven't got my email telling me to change my password, though of course I know I had to by other means. But large organizations can usually do have security teams that can look back at what might have been happening on their systems and go, okay, well, now that we know that these guys got into our systems, what could they have had access to?
Mm.
And eBay assure us that of the various databases they have, this was the one that they may have had access to with personal details on eBay. but nothing connected with any of the card transactions or balances of accounts, and nothing connected with PayPal at all. On the PayPal side, they are a financial transactions institution at the same level of authority, if you like, as a bank or a credit card processing company. So in theory, we would hope that they're using the same levels of security. One of the big advantages they have is because they are so big, they can look out for patterns of activity. The banks do the same here too. If you have a credit card transaction, they will know that, hang on, how can you be ordering pizza in Perth when half an hour ago you were standing in front of an ATM in Newcastle taking out cash?
So those big companies have security experts tracking what's being done, where, what transactions are taking place, and cross-checking them.
Absolutely. They
can, that's good.
The location of, you know, if you've got a smartphone and you've got your banking app on it, the bank can, and I don't know, not all banks will do this yet, but it's certainly something that they can include as part of their security if you know, they get around to incorporate it. They know where your phone is physically. So it could be, you know, as I say, how can you be taking out money from an ATM in Melbourne when your phone says you're not in Melbourne?
So can we talk about where your phone is for the minute? This week, Apple, the iPhones and the iPad had a ransom attack based on some software within those devices. The Find My iPhone device, which is technically like a GPS kind of thing, isn't it? Where you can track the phone and know where it is. Can you explain a little bit about what happened with these Apple devices? Some of our listeners may have been affected.
Yeah, we're still getting our head around exactly how many people might have been hit by this, and it seems that the attack is still unfolding, and no one really seems to know yet, you know, why it's happening, let alone who's doing it. But this sort of Find My iPhone, Find My iPad feature, and the companies that make Android phones and Microsoft's, you know, Windows phones and so on have similar sorts of features. It's designed to be used if your device gets lost or stolen. So provided you turn it on and provided the device is turned on, you can then go to, you know, Apple's website, log in and say, okay, my phone has been lost, and then you have the choice of what do you want to do with it. You can either just wipe it and erase all the data from it and make it useless. You can lock it if you have not already locked it. I mean, you should have a PIN or a passphrase on it so that, you know, no one can just pick up your phone and use it, but I know a lot of people find that, you know, difficult and annoying. it's very bad practice.
We'll talk about passwords a little bit later.
We'll get to that. Or you can essentially lock it and then pop up a message and say, this phone belongs to Sally Knight, please phone me for a reward, and, you know, arrange for the phone to come back. Or you can just make a really loud beeping sound because you've just lost it behind the couch or something and can't find your phone.
That's probably happens to me a lot.
happens to us all. So small and convenient now, aren't they?
What happened is
bad guy or guys or girls, Oleg Pliss was the name that, you know, that was popped up. We assume that that was not the person's real name. Somehow got into people's Apple accounts and was then taking over their phone, putting a passcode on it and saying, I have locked your phone. If you want your phone unlocked, you'll need to send $50 or $100 to thus and such address. So that kind of attack is called ransomware, where you're holding a device ransom. There's other kind of ransomware attacks, and we can talk about them later. But in this case, it was happening, oddly enough, with Australians nearly exclusively at first, and these Apple devices. We haven't worked out what the common element might have been apart from that, but we suspect it's because if someone has an email address and a password to log in at some website somewhere, if that is stolen, if those login details are stolen, you know, a hacker breaks into that service and steals their username and password list, one of the first things that they can do is try to see whether that email address and password list allows them to log in other places.
All right, so That is definitely one we'll talk about. So if they get your password and your details and you log in from one sort of device or one sort of website, then they will most likely try it on other things.
Absolutely, because in so many...
Because most of us have the same password for everything, because our memory is not that great.
Exactly. And we, as you say, we can get onto passwords, because this is the big one. This is the fundamental security mistake people make that gets them into trouble every time. Your passwords, especially for core sites, need to be different for every single site. And as you say, Sally, well, how do I remember them all?
Well,
you can't. We have computers to remember things for us.
Well, we might take some callers now, but if you do have a special way that you remember your passwords, then you feel free to call us, or any comments. Perhaps you've been attacked. You've been cyber attacked or had, been hacked yourself. You can call 1-300-800-222. Let's head to Luke now. Hi, Luke.
How you doing?
Good. How are you this morning?
Oh, a little bit tired, but apart from that, I'm all right.
Have you been playing PlayStation all night?
No, but I am 18, so that would be the usual thing.
So your friend's PlayStation Grand Theft Auto account got hacked?
Yes, it did.
What happened?
Lucky for him, it must have been someone who was feeling mighty generous, because they hacked him and then gave him $1 billion on the game.
What?
Yeah, they gave him $1 billion.
That's not possible. Silgarian, what is that possible?
Well, it's possible. I'm trying to think. I've got smacked, Luke. Why would anyone do that? I mean, I assume your friend is a wonderful human being that we'd want to give $1 billion to.
No. You can be a jerk sometimes.
Thank you very much, Luke, for your call.
Okay, look, there's two threads that maybe it's the friend trying to cover up the fact that he's found some way of depositing a lot of game money in his account.
Game money, right. Money, right.
Not your actual $1 billion.
Right. There you go.
I hope I'll have to check with him. If there is, I want this guy's address.
Yeah, me too.
To do this.
It's a very generous hacker. Yeah,
the hack is probably... You know, given that we're not seeing a wave of other attacks against this particular service, it's probably, a phishing attack. Somehow the password has been entered into another site or obtained by other means. Mm. I forgot to mention a couple of other common ways that sort of thing can be done, is that once someone's got malicious software on your computer's become infected. We used to call them viruses. That's kind of a generic term that's starting to fade and go out of style. We just call them malware now for malicious software, because it saves us going, is it a virus? Is it a worm? Is it another different kind of...
Can we backtrack slightly, still, Gary? So
we're racing it.
We are. We're racing miles ahead. Would you refer to this as man-in-the-middle attack? Is that a word that you...
That is a thing.
Is that a thing?
That is a thing, and it could be caused by that. Let me explain what a man-in-the-middle attack is. You know, when you go to a secure website, or a website that is supposed to be secure, and you see that little padlock icon come up in your web browser that says this is a secure link, and it says it's an HTTPS connection instead of HTTP, the S being for secure. The process by which that is set up is that your web browser will say, okay, I'm connecting to you. There's an exchange of identity information and cryptographic information, and then both ends of the equation go, yep, we're happy with that. Show the padlock. All's good.
Mm-hmm.
Man-in-the-middle attack is when the connection between your web browser or your PlayStation or whatever it might be and the secure remote site is intercepted by someone in the middle who is managing to convince your end of the connection that they are the legitimate destination. And so what they will do is they'll say, yep, you're connected to Sony, in the case of PlayStation, except it's not really Sony, and they can then decrypt the encrypted secure data, which is your login and password or whatever, and they can then do whatever they want with that, record it for later, then re-encrypt the data, connect it onto Sony, and... It all
so it's
both ends and sitting in the middle.
So it's a little sort of mini intercept while you're trying to do a secure login or a secure transaction.
That's not so much
malware on the device.
No. So something happening somewhere in the middle.
Oh, okay.
It might be malware on your device that causes you to be redirected to the wrong place, the bad guy's website, rather than directly to where you're meant to be going. So a lot of this stuff gets very difficult to explain without pictures, simply because it's not one simple thing that's going on. You'll often have multiple things happening as part of an attack. And if you think, why would anyone bother doing that on that scale?
Mm.
Well, it's all automated. Again, I keep saying,
The internet is
made of computers. Mm. Computers can do things hundreds or thousands or millions of people at a time.
Kathy's got a question pretty similar to what you've kind of just mentioned. Kathy, how are you this morning?
Oh, confused, and I'm not computer savvy either.
Confused. Yeah, it is very confusing. Stilgarian's with us, and he says that particularly
Great.
Without pictures and without seeing it in front of you, it's all these really big words, and it's very confusing. But what did you want to ask?
My question is, I'm on Gumtree for the first time, and I've actually got my address visible. Is that unwise?
You're talking here, Kathy, about your home address visible?
Yeah.
Look, it's one of those things. I ask people, do you have your address in the telephone book?
Yes, I do.
So people can find your address anyway.
Yeah, because I can't afford a silent number on the white pages.
See, I know this is the trick. You have to pay extra to keep yourself private, and that's the way it's always been. And some privacy experts think it's.
Yeah. So there's no problem with me having my mobile number and my address on my Gumtree ads.
Look, I would be hesitant. I would take it down. It's one of those difficult situations in that if you're buying and selling things online, then having real details makes you appear more trustworthy.
Yeah, I always get sucked in and ripped off, yeah.
And you go, oh, that's a real person with a real address, then again, how would you know?
But I wanted to also ask you is that...
I take it off, Kathy. I'll put it that way.
Another quick question.
If Gumtree allows you to do it, just put the minimal amount there, and then you can reveal information to someone once you've made a deal.
All right, the other quick question I wanted to ask is that if they... someone from overseas wants to deposit money into my bank account or whatever. I don't have any money worth having, but is there a possibility that they could steal my identity by depositing or knowing my bank account details?
Theoretically, yes. In practice, it's a relatively low risk because if they've just got the bank account number, they would need to also have other details about your identity to authorise taking money out. I mean, anyone can deposit money in, that's fine. This bank account number, put money in. But to take money out, they would also need your bank login details if you use internet banking, or if in a physical world, they'd need your signature and something like that. So it's possible, but not something you should worry about. And I think the other important thing to realise is if it does happen, your bank will refund the money from the fraudulent transaction, and they will then chase the criminals.
Thank you very much. Stilgarian is with us this morning, and he is an internet security expert, technology commentator as well. If you've got any questions, 1-300-800-222 is the number. It is quite tricky to get your head around. We do have some more callers that I'd like to get through before we talk a bit more. Wayne, you're on the road.
Yes, I am.
What did you want to mention?
I got a phone call from an Indian call centre saying they were from Microsoft and they picked up problems with my computer and they wanted to talk me in a way of getting into it so they could take control and fix the problems.
Wayne, they're criminals. Hang up on them.
Yeah, well, I couldn't understand what they were saying, so I hung up on them. But I keep getting a phone call every 2 or 3 months now.
Yeah, look, once they've got a number and you didn't immediately hang up, they will try again. This is a scam. This is an absolute scam. Microsoft will never phone you to tell you that there's a problem with the computer. We've also seen it done by people saying they're from Telstra. And look, this is one worth mentioning because a lot of people get caught by this.
Thank you very much for that, Wayne, by the way.
Thank you, Wayne. Yep. Yeah, because, you know, he's done the right thing. Microsoft tell me, or they told me a couple of years ago, that in their call centre, one in six calls they get is from people that get caught by this scam and then are trying to work out what they can do about it. What happens is that they'll phone you up, the criminals will phone you up, and it's all well organised. They're calling from a call centre. There's even been an Indian call centre caught where some of the staff had organised this, so if they were having a bit of a slow spot, they'd just start making these calls. And they say, look, the scam is, they say, we're calling from Microsoft, or Telstra, or Big Pond, and we've detected a problem on your computer, so can we just talk you through that and fix the problem? And they talk you through some stuff, and you follow it on your computer screen, and they manage to do something that brings up a window that will show a big spray of deeply technical error messages, or so they tell you that's what it is. And it's been funny when they phoned some technical experts and they've gone through it and they've gone, this is not error messages, this is just technical stuff down in the thing that most people don't see. But it looks technical and confusing, and then they say, oh yeah, look, we can see that there's dozens of viruses here on your computer. We really are going to need to disinfect this, but that's a paid service. So, they might do it in one of two orders. They might say that's a paid service, so we'll just need to get your credit card details, and then okay, they're going to steal money from you that way. The other option is they say, so if you could just authorize us, go to in a web browser to a certain place and authorize us to log into your computer, we will fix it. And at that point, you are authorizing their remote computer to connect into yours and take control. And what they then do is install the malware, the malicious software, which allows them to come back later, monitor your computer. More importantly, they can monitor your email, every keystroke that you type on the keyboard, looking out for further login details, passwords, that sort of thing, which allows them to get access to more of your stuff online, read your email and build up more information about you, and start working towards stealing your identity for more crime down the track.
You are listening to ABC Overnights. I'm Sally Knight, and Stilgarian is my guest this morning talking about internet security. We've had a few people on the text message coming through. Sue from Ulladulla says she's been quite amazed. She's received a phone call from a card company and has been asked to ID herself, and they were quite taken aback by that, and she refused and then asked them to ID themselves, and I don't know what happened at the end, but Sue, but I think she was kind of a bit clued on to what was going on.
Sue's done good things there, absolutely.
Yep.
If you have any doubts when someone phones up and says they're from your bank or your card processing company or whatever it might be, ask them for their name and then go back, look up the phone number yourself for that bank or that credit card company, their security number, and then phone them back and say, I've just got a phone call from so-and-so.
Yep, so retrace the steps.
Because it may be legitimate. I mean, I've stood in front, I remember one time I visited Bangkok in Thailand. I got to the airport, got off the plane, went to an ATM to get out some local cash, took some money out of the ATM, And then as I was turning away from the ATM, my phone rang and it was thus and such bank security, where are you standing right now? And I said, at an ATM at Bangkok Airport, and they went, good, that's where we've just detected you. That's all good. How long will you be visiting? We'll just write those dates down.
It's better than them cancelling your cards altogether,
absolutely,
isn't it? Now another text has come in saying, Sally, as just about all breaches are done via the internet, I keep an analog, an old-fashioned paper address book with hundreds of websites and passwords in a safe. This has been a 100% secure method to date for over 20 years. Thank you, Adri, for your message.
That's not such a bad idea. Now, I know that we keep getting told never write down your PINs, never write down your passwords.
Mm.
But one of the top security real gurus on the planet, a guy called Bruce Schneier, he's written books on the site, like textbooks on this stuff. And his career is one of those which just says, worked for the US military for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and no details, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Here's one of the clearest thinkers on this stuff. And he said, what's the one thing that you make sure is with you wherever you go, and that's your wallet or purse? It's got your credit cards in it, it's got your ID in it, and so on. So put your most important complex passwords on a slip of paper inside that. Mask them so they look a bit like something else, like you can include a classic way as if you write down a sentence, but it's actually the first letter of each word is the password, or the second letter of each word, or a thing like that. The suggestion to have it separate, difficult to remember passwords for each thing, put them in the safe. Yeah, that works. Now, that said, you do still have to use those passwords on the internet, so they can be intercepted by the man in the middle attack we mentioned before, or a phishing attack.
Phishing.
Look, and if it's first thing in the morning or it's late at night and you've had a shandy or two and you're just checking your bank, and it might be, you know, when you're feeling a bit vulnerable, you may not notice, hang on, is that really my bank's website, you know, that I'm connecting to there? So mistakes do happen, but then when that does happen, or that site gets hacked and your details are stolen or whatever, that's just one thing you need to change, one password you need to change, and the rest are okay. That's why it comes back. Set passwords for everything.
We've got Tim on the line. Hi, Tim.
How are you?
I'm good. You've got a question for Stilgarian.
I do. When you get your new key cards, they send out your PIN number to you, but then you've got to ring the bank to actually activate it. Where does that PIN number and that get stored when they activate it?
They are doing a similar thing there, Tim, with what we do with passwords. They are taking... They may not necessarily store the PIN number itself. PIN number, PIN, VN is number. They are taking your card number and the PIN, combining it, doing a mathematical operation on it, and if it comes up with the right sum at the end, they know you've stored the right PIN or entered the right PIN, and so that's okay. So they're probably not storing the PIN itself. That's why it's always a case of, we can't tell you what the PIN is, but we can issue you with a new one if you've forgotten. The other interesting thing there that helps reassure people about what's going on at that point is that voice print technology is a thing. So they're asking you to phone and activate your card, because then they've got a record of the phone number you called from, where you were when you made that phone call, and a recording of your voice, and it helps them match up your identity. Simplink, for example, uses voice print technology for logging in. They have for a number of years. If you're phoning up to check something on your Centrelink account, it asks you to say your address and your account number and so on. And they use that to make sure it's the same voice print as the last time you phoned in.
All right, you're on ABC Overnight. So we're speaking with Stilgarian about internet security. Next week is actually Stay Smart Online Week. I think it was formerly called National Cyber Security Awareness Week, but it's shortened the name. So, trying to get people more aware of the internet and at work or at home or at school and what goes on, and just trying to be aware of it. Well, one other thing I wanted to mention this morning that someone's texted in and reminded me, actually. Facebook have recently they've announced a new feature to the app which will let Facebook be able to listen into conversations, to our conversations surrounding through our phone's microphone.
That's the fear, certainly, Sally.
That's really scary for me.
Well, yeah, it's... Look, I have concerns about any any app that starts saying that they're going to be doing things. But Facebook has put up a kind of FAQ, frequently asked questions, on this, in which they assure it's not listening into your conversations. What they are doing at this stage, and I must emphasize this, as I said on a TV program the other night, personally I trust Facebook as far as I could spit a cow. But because their business is gathering more data about you. That's what they do. That's how they make their profit. So, you know, let's not be naive about this. That's, you know, what that they aim to do. But they are saying that this is to allow them to see and allow you to post more easily details about what music you're listening to or what TV programs you're watching. So what is happening at this stage is that if you have the feature turned on, and you can turn it off, if you are currently typing a Facebook status update, then they will turn on the microphone for 15 seconds, have a bit of a listen to what's happening around, and it will, this is all happening in your app, in your phone at this stage, but it will, if it hears music, it will create a fingerprint of that music, you know, its rhythm, its beat, its melody, the patterns of sound in it.
So it'll do all these things, but it won't actually listen into what we're saying on phone calls and conversations and stuff like that.
That's what they're saying.
All right. So, but it has the does it have the capability to do that?
Well,
probably. I don't know.
Not if they don't put it in. I mean, if Facebook is lying about this, then they're deeply in the poo-poo. But they're saying that this little signature, this fingerprint of the sound, will be made on the phone. Mm. That signature will be sent off to match against other signatures they have. And it will be, that music with that pattern, that's Lady Gaga. Or that pattern of speech and dialogue with the soaring strings at the end, that's a snippet from this episode of Game of Thrones, and you're watching that. And they're saying that it can't do things like identify voices, let alone understand the words in the conversation. Now that said, Microsoft showed a feature the other day where in Skype video calls, it could translate from one language to the other in real time. So you're doing a Skype video chat with someone across the internet, you're speaking English, it translates it into French, and at the other end, out comes French with the computer voice, they speak French, and it's translated back into English for you.
That's really cool.
That is very cool. Extremely cool, but it means that your voice is going via the Skype servers at Microsoft and back, and that gives them the potential to record and analyze everything you say in that conversation.
I didn't even think of that part of it.
That said, they can do that anyway, in the same way that, someone could be listening to my phone calls. Well, anyone at the telephone company could be listening to your phone calls.
Now,
they have rules, obviously, to follow.
We've got a few more callers to get through, 5 minutes until the news, and then I wanted to kind of just get you to reiterate how people or how listeners can really be really tight on their security online, some tips and tricks, okay? So one more caller here from DJ. What was your question?
Oh, just in relation to Apple computers and so forth, they have their own sort of security or virus protection built into them via updates. Like, is it better off you just buy that and buy an Apple computer and so be it, rather than pay yearly subscriptions if you got some other sort of computer like a
Android or a Windows or something?
Yeah.
Thanks, DJ, for your question. What do you think, Stilgarian?
Look, traditionally, Apple's operating systems were designed from the ground up in a way that is overall more secure, and because there are more Windows computers out there than Macs on people's desks, then the bad guys, who are in organized crime is a business too, and they're not going to spend the money trying to break into computers that are only a smaller percentage of the population. So traditionally, antivirus on a Mac was not as important. This is not so much the case anymore, because the kind of attacks that we're seeing are attacks that antivirus doesn't actually help you against. And in fact, the biggest antivirus company in the world, Symantec, which makes Norton antivirus, came out a few weeks ago and said what others had been saying. Antivirus actually isn't the important thing anymore. It's behaviours that people need to get into that to prevent them being at risk. So
can we go through a couple of those things to wrap up with? What should we be doing? How can we stay safe or secure online to finish up?
Okay. Antivirus, yes, you must have it still. It's a bit like, you know, saying, although we've cured smallpox, you do still need to take your vaccine in case you're travelling, or yellow fever or whatever it might be. Okay, so do make sure you have up-to-date security software and keep it. Same for all of the other software on your devices.
Make sure it's up to date as well.
When it says there's an update, make sure it's up to date. Don't leave it till later. Those are security fixes. Use different strong passwords for everything. Buy strong passwords as long as possible. Make them random if you can, difficult to remember. And if you have any doubts about a service, change the password straight away. And to keep track of all of those passwords, use password management software. It's only a few dollars, and then you have a computer program where it works across your devices. There's plenty to choose from on the market. You only have to remember one really good long password to unlock that. And that password manager then becomes your gateway into all of the other programs and will remember all of the passwords for you. And that way, you don't even know what the passwords are yourself. And it means, I want to log into this or log into that, press a button. It's the way to go.
So an easy way to remember all your passwords and to keep them in one place, make sure they're long and capital letters, small letters, and update your software. Make sure you've got your security software.
Yep.
And just be aware of...
And be suspicious of every link before you click on it.
Yeah, every link that you click on and every phone call that you get or request for data for your personal information. Yeah. Don't just give it away willy-nilly.
No need to be totally paranoid. But it's a bit like crossing the road. You do look both ways before crossing the road every time, even if it's a quiet street.
Nice analogy. I like that one.
No need to be paranoid about it. It's just a public safety thing, you know. Be aware of what is happening around you, same as you would when you're walking out on the street.
Look, thank you very much. We've been speaking with Stilgherrian, technology commentator and expert on internet security. We could go on for hours on this subject. There's so much that we could talk about, but we only had an hour, and we really appreciate your time, Stilgherrian. So thank you very much.
Great fun.
Have a wonderful Saturday.
You too.